1, 2, 3. You ever hear about Blind Lemon Jefferson? He had quite a style. People down in Texas in those days, well, they'd come for miles to listen to the big man play. And then they'd say, Ain't that something? Yeah, ain't that something? You ever hear Billie Holiday? She was singing her song, and everything was just right, right where it belonged, gardenias in her midnight hair. She could take you anywhere.
Ain't that something?
Yeah, ain't that something? 'Cause if that ain't something,
something ain't nothing at all.
There have been performances in public places in every major culture in the world, all the way back to antiquity. For many musicians, street performance was the most common means of employment for musicians before the advent of recording and personal electronics. There were organ grinders busking in the 19th and 20th century streets, and Romani musicians, dancers, fortune tellers from the Mediterranean coast to the north of England and throughout the rest of Europe. And then there were medicine shows, artists, and mariachis, one-man bands, bluesmen, and folk singers, putting themselves out there on the streets and plazas and subways of our world. That brings us to singer-songwriter, social activist, organizer, and champion of the busker, Jim Page. Jim tours internationally and has about 23 albums to his name, but his roots belong to street performing. Bonnie Raitt said, "Jim's been writing great topical songs for as long as I can remember, bringing his acute wit and wry humor to a host of subjects that can really use both. In the tradition of Woody and Dylan, he cuts right to the heart with music you actually enjoy listening to. I'm a longtime admirer," says Bonnie Raitt. Jim will be in concert this Saturday, September 16th, at the Palindrome, 1893 South Jacob Miller Road. The doors open at 7 and showtime is at 7:30. Jim Page, welcome to KPTZ.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, tell us about the song we opened with. It's the first song off your latest album.
Well, it started out, believe it or not, as a meditation on watching Miles Davis play the horn. I was on a YouTube jag, you know, and he was a fascinating character and a great musician. And he would wrap himself around it almost like he was holding it secret from the rest of the world. And he was communing with the horn. And then something would begin to emerge and he would kind of straighten up and bring it out. And it was interesting. And I just kept watching it and I was going to just kind of do something. But what the song wanted to say was not somebody that lived in Malibu and drove a yellow Maserati, but somebody that, you know, was from the other side of the tracks. So I wanted to talk about that. And so Miles Davis turned into Blind Lemon Jefferson. And then of course there's Billie Holiday, because what the song wanted to say was that your dreams don't always come true. And music isn't something that you do simply because you want to get famous and have a boat, but you want to do it because of the beauty of it and the impactful importance of it to the world and to other people and to yourself, which is what both of those people did. It's in the song, you know, Lemon went to Chicago to get, you know, do a record thing and, you know, maybe get famous, whatever. And he froze to death during the wintertime on the sidewalk, you know, and Billie went through some terrible stuff. She was one of the first test cases for the new anti-drug laws in America. And she was ruined and she was basically murdered by the medical system and by the, you know, political system. So they're both examples of this great musical artistic work that is left to the world while they themselves, they died young, basically penniless. And then the song makes the reference to, this is kind of my theory, but I think I'm right. A lot of people, if not most people, are at their best singing when they don't think anybody's listening. Because then you relax and then you just kind of sing the melody. And when there's somebody listening, it's like, well, you want to perform, like you've seen Mick Jagger perform. But if you just sing, it's just a beautiful thing. You know, and the singer says, can't we go somewhere and dance slowly? Everything is so fast these days. And it's just a meditation on what music is and how it is presented to us. It's what it's supposed to be, that only certain people can do it. Well, you know what I'm saying.
Ain't that something?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And all you can do is shake your head. Ain't that something?
Yeah.
That's how it works. Isn't that weird?
Well, you perform all over the Northwest. Folklife, Portland's River City Festival, the Moisture Festival, the yearly concert at the Peace Arch, all kinds of clubs and venues in the Northwest and beyond.
This trip to Kerrville is going to be the first out of walking distance practically that I've done. Have plans to get into Ireland in the spring, like mid-April going into May. So, you know, there's that in the works too. Things are starting to open up. My love of what I do lies in actually in writing songs, in learning them, in sculpting them, in playing them wherever I am. What I did to myself when I was a kid was that I just said no to the barrier that says you can't play here, you have to play over there. No, I can play wherever. There's a bunch of people sitting on the lawn over there. I'm going to go play to them. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's people passing by at the university. I'm going to go play over there. Oh, there's an opera house. I wonder if I can get in there to play in there. I've played everywhere. So the street corner, it needs to be respected. That is it's a stage. I used to say that I wore my stage on the bottom of my feet. That's how I used to say it. And that was true. I go into a bus station. If it's right, if conditions are right, that's my stage. You know, Opera House, Paramount Northwest, that was my stage. All these different venues, that was my stage. University, the street fairs, those are all stages. I don't know how to say this exactly, but you shouldn't really draw straight lines between sound system and no sound system. Because when you don't have a microphone and a soundboard, then your sound system becomes the buildings around you, the trees, the overhang, if there's an overhang, the way that the buildings wrap around you to project. Those are all sound systems. So it doesn't really matter. There's like this porous thing that happens between a soundboard and no soundboard, but you're always working a sound system.
You were instrumental, though, in preserving the busker's life in Seattle.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was doing that myself. And I was threatened with arrest, and I know people that were arrested for doing that. And you have to remember, this was 1974, and that was Watergate. Mm-hmm. And that was secrets. Okay, busking was not a word I used until probably the 90s. Mm-hmm. I didn't even run across it.
Right.
You know, I'm a Yank. You know, it's like I'm a street singer. That's how I saw myself, right. Street singer. More common about that phrase. I've always preferred it, street singer. The way I looked at the street singer was always like they're the town crier. They're the one that goes out there, and if a scandal has just broken in the police department, but it hasn't reached the newspapers yet, you go out there and sing it now. You go out there and sing about it now because people have a need to know about the scandal in the police department or whatever might be going on. That was the important job of the street singer to me, and that's what I did. Making sure that I could sing on the street or anybody else could sing on the street also simultaneously made sure that the people had access to news and they had access to information. You know what I mean? Making it illegal is a gag order.
Yeah.
We have to, you know, as Julian Assange, we have to stop that. We have to keep talking, not less talking, more talking. So that was my whole idea. And I had an advocate in the city government. And I had a couple of advocates in some of the newspapers. We got an open city council meeting, an entire meeting dedicated to the busking issue. That's all it was for. Because what you were basically going to do would be amend the city code. So it's kind of deep tissue massage.
Right.
So it was fairly serious. So, okay. So it was, I don't know, Tuesday afternoon at 2:30 or something like that. 1974, April, I think. So I made up flyers, 8.5 by 11 flyers. Jim Page, live at City Council Chambers, 2:30, April 14th or whatever the date was. And then I put those around town everywhere that I played. I was kind of sneaky also. Like I played a lot at the campus and had a big following at the campus. He was really cool, man. And students have to start early, a lot of them, right? So they would take the bus and they would get off and they would walk right by like Andy Shiga's, which was a store there on the corner of 43rd and University. Andy Shiga's or a lot of other places, they don't want posters in their windows, but I want my poster in the window. And I used tape and I put it on the window outside and I knew it'd be taken down, but I knew also it would be up long enough for those students to see it. So I did that as well. And I got them all over town and, you know, we had basically a standing room only. Event at the concert at the
at the Chambers.
Yeah, I only did one song though. I wrote
another
a song
stage
especially for it.
Yeah,
you know.
For those of you that just tuned in, we're speaking with Jim Page, singer-songwriter, who will be performing at the Palindrome at 1893 South Jacob Miller Road in Port Townsend. You came into Seattle around what, 1971?
Seventy-one.
You're from Palo Alto, yeah.
I was born there. I was raised in Cupertino. You know. Oh, my God. I had no idea what that place was going to turn into.
I grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in San Jose, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, wow. I did. But my family moved. I was born in Seattle, but my family moved down there when it was still the Garden of Eden down there.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a question for you. How did your relationship with artist Spoon Man begin?
Well, he says he picked me up hitchhiking in 71. I don't remember that. First time I remember was I played all the rock bars because when I got here, Seattle had one folk club and it closed. I played there like three times or something. It was called the DMZ in Fremont and it closed. Uh-huh. So I was despondent. And this bartender guy there in Fremont said, well, they have music across the street over there. There's a bar called the Library. And I said, that's a rock and roll bar. And he looked at me like, boy, are you dumb. And he actually did shrug his shoulders. And he said, they take breaks, don't they? Wow, I hadn't thought of it. That took a bit of gumption to get myself to do that because I had no idea how to do that. I'm one guy with a guitar, and I'm going to play a break in between sets of a five-piece electric rock and roll band. How do I do this? Now, I was living on the money, paying the rent. Okay. So I not only had to do it, they had to like what I did. And then when I passed the hat, they had to put money in. I was very strict with myself. Don't ever ask for money. And by that, I mean, just tell them what you're going to do, but don't ask for it. And when you get off the stage, do not say a word. Just walk around and hello, nod your head. The only word you're allowed to say is thank you. I've seen people go around. I saw this one guy go around and say, hey, I was just on stage playing. And I'm thinking, if you have to tell them you were on stage playing, then I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. So anyway, one of the places I played was called the Medicine Show, Pike and Minor. And I was there one night. And this interesting character with a lot of energy came up. And that was artist. He came up and said, hey, I play spoons. Can I play with you on one song, just one song? And I looked at him and I thought, well, you know, I'm really new in town. I don't know who this guy is. I don't know how much part of the Medicine Show he is, but this is interesting. So yeah, let's do this. Because if you're wearing the stage on the bottom of your feet, and if you have poked holes in the wall that means the difference between the opera house and the bus station, if you've done all those things, then you also have to poke holes in the wall between the entertainer and the people who were supposed to be entertained, right? So here comes this guy who wants to play spoons. Sure, man. Yeah, sure. Let's try it out. What have you got to lose, right? I do not remember what he did, but it was really interesting, you know, and that was the first time I met him. That was artist. That was the first time I met him. Then I'd run into him from time to time, walking across the Burnside Bridge in Portland, stuff like that, you know, and I remember him walking along, talking to him. And he said, excuse me a minute. I have to go do something. He said, wait right here. And he went into a bar and I stood out in the street. And after about a minute and a half, this enormous cheering and applause exploded from the room. And then a few more minutes went by. He was gone like maybe 15 minutes at the max.
Yeah.
And then he came out and he'd gone and done a set. Yeah. Extraordinary character. But that's how we met. That's how we met that I remember.
And you guys hung on the out front of the Pike Place Market quite a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, that was fun. It was really good for a while there. We played a lot in front of that famous coffee shop. Mostly that was our place. It was flat, you know, because you got to move when you play. And if it's a lumpy sort of a thing, you could trip yourself up. So it's flat.
Right.
There's an overhang so you don't get wet. And it also collects the sound. That's your sound system,
mm-hmm.
you know. And yeah, and I was writing a lot of songs because people would tell me things.
That brings us to your latest album, and what you were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah, right.
You know, what people say and what they do and what happens at any particular stage or what happens after, you know, the prime of your life or whatever it is, you know, it's the Ain't That Something part of it.
Yeah.
Tell us about that album, how you put it together, and who helped you do it.
Everybody did. The album produced itself. I had the last word, but it produced itself like I talked to the bass player. He says, well, how about this? And so we go back and do that and try that. And the engineer, Floyd Retzma, did the mix. Man, he's like a collage artist on that thing, man. He's really, really good. He made all those parts work together. I mean, they were great parts, but he made them work. He made them work in sync. Dune was the most recent person that I played with without any experience playing with. Oh, and JR, the singer. I hadn't worked with her before either. Dune. I like Dune. I met him at the country fair, Oregon Country Fair, and then I met him again up here, and I wanted to play with somebody on a regular basis that would give me some sort of solidity that I could work on arrangements and stuff. And there he was at the right time, and he knew a drummer, so we did this little trio thing just in the basement, right, getting ready. And Orville and I had been talking about doing something. I had come back from New York City with some half-baked recordings that had parts that I liked and parts that I didn't. And I was playing to Orville, and Orville was listening, and he was making suggestions and stuff. And I said, hey, why don't you come on over and check out this thing that we're doing in the basement? Do you mind? He said, no. So he showed up. You know, and musicians are, by and large, quite generous and open-minded people. So if you bring somebody in, they'll go, oh, sure, let's try it out. Especially someone like Orville, whose reputation precedes him.
Right.
So he comes in with his electric guitar, and he sets himself up, and we play. And everybody just hit it off. It's like, oh, my God, this is great. So Orville and I walked out afterwards, and we looked at each other and at the same time said, why don't we just do this rather than deal with those old things from New York and then different. Why don't we do this? So personnel changed. The drummer changed. But Dune stayed there. So me and Orville and Dune. And then Joel Litwin, who is a drummer up in Bellingham, whose expertise is soundscaping a song. If I could speak for him, I don't know if he would like that or not. But he brags that if necessary, he can be the quietest drummer in the world. He can be. He can be very quiet. And he can play what the song does. And then Jessica Lurie, who was one of the first inspirations to expanding musically at this time in my life, and that happened by accident. Also, she lives in New York City, so I had to like arrange for, and this was during, it was recorded during the pandemic, so there were a lot of protocols in place. So me and Dune and Joel, you know, me and bass and drums, played simultaneously at the studio Litho here in Seattle. So we played all the songs ensemble, the three of us, and then decided on what songs to use. And then I would be sending things to Orville or meeting him somewhere and handing him off a thumb drive with stuff on. He's got his own gear at home, and he would just play it and then ship those to me. It just sent me MP3s, and I'd listen to it. And the thing that you miss is the banter between players when you're in the studio, and they say, you know, and when they're done playing something, you can walk right in and say, that's really cool, but could you do such and such? That's all gone because of the time lag, because he emails me an MP3, because I listen to it. I put it on my little earbud thing, and I go walk around the neighborhood hearing what he did and trying to critique it and, you know, blah, all this stuff. So it's, everything slowed down in that respect. And then I had to get Jessica and JR in there on the same day, and that happened November or December, I can't remember. Anyway, it was slow, but not because it was hard. It was slow because of COVID. Ed Brooks at Resident Mastering mastered it, and he did an amazing. He actually emailed me and said, thank you for letting me listen to this. So it's like, it was really good, but it produced itself because the players were good, because everybody was into it. I mean, everything was just perfect. It was just right, you know, and the studio was good and the engineer was good. And yeah, so I'm 74 now. Okay. I don't know how old you are, but I graduated from high school in 67 down in California, right? I mean, there weren't even any cassette tapes. You know, there was reel to reel. You know, I had a little reel to reel tape recorder that I got from somebody. And I think the belt broke and I used like a rubber band or something to keep it going. And people made records, vinyl records.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. And to this day, people want to say records or CDs, and I say they're all records because that's short for recording. So I'm 74. All these years later, So I make the record and I make CDs. And then I think, okay, now what do we do? How do we do this? Because it's a streaming culture. It's a download culture. CDs are even passe.
Yeah, it's all different now.
It's so, I don't know what in the world to do. So I'm asking people, and it's like, you know, what do you do? I'm asking people who say, they're in the business, they're players. Say, I don't know. We just put it out. So everybody's in the same thing where you make something and then what? It's very weird. So, I mean, the good part of it is things don't really go stale. They're still there. You know, I get airplay and I sell the, I sold a few for a while there and then it kind of backed off. But, you know, it's interesting. It's a very weird world in that respect right now.
Yeah, it's a challenging time for musicians that, you know, want a piece of the pie. That's for sure.
Right.
You know, from streaming. So,
well, you want to get paid for your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, streaming is like what's taking place of, it's so weird, man. Streaming is taking place of your radio. So people have their own radio stations.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of cool. But if it stops you from discovering other music because you're only listening to what you already know you like.
Yeah.
I think that's sad.
Well, I mean, if you have algorithms or artificial intelligence that are putting together something that ordinarily you'd want to curate yourself, that's a whole different thing, isn't it?
I always got a kick out of that phrase, artificial intelligence. Is that like having a pretend brain?
Yeah, I know.
You know?
Well, the name of the album that we're talking about is The Time Is Now. Mm-hmm. And you're coming to the Palindrome this Saturday. Tell our listeners what to expect when you get there to the Palindrome.
Well, I don't know what to expect because I don't know who's going to be coming. It might be infested with bats before I get there. But it's going to be a solo show unless I get, you know, a wild hare, H-A-R-E. There might be a surprise or two.
I'm in for that. I love surprises.
Yeah, so, good.
So there you are. Well, Jim Page, what song are we going to go out with?
We are going to go out with a song called Angeline. In song form, it's the story of Chief Seattle's daughter, Kiki Soul Blue, who was renamed Angeline by the wife of Doc Maynard, one of the founding wealthy business people of Seattle, who famously told this beautiful, important person, "You're much too beautiful for such an ugly name.
Ooh.
From now on, you will be Princess Angeline."
Ooh.
That's creepy. So anyway, that's what the song is about. And it's, I hope it makes sense. And I hope you like the music.
Jim Page, we're looking forward to seeing you. It's been a while since you and I had a conversation. So this was great. I could talk to you for hours. So what else?
Well, Chris, we may do that someday. You know, that would be fun. We're the same age. We grew up in the same part of the country.
Yeah. All right. Jim Page coming to the Palindrome. Saturday, September 16th, the doors open at 7, and the show starts at 7:30, and that's at the Palindrome, 1893 South Jacob Miller Road, right here in Port Townsend. Looking forward to having you visit the town that time forgot, as they say.
The town that time envies is how I look at it. You know, I mean, it's a great place with excellent people there, really excellent people in Port Townsend. So I look forward to it.
All right, Jim. See you Saturday. Thanks.
All right, Chris.
So much.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Okay, bye. In this beautiful country in which I'm living, there is a story that you'll find about a woman named Kiki Soul Blue, and how they called her Angeline. Angeline, Kiki Soul Blue. She was the eldest daughter of Chief Seattle. She watched the world disappear. said you can build your town around me. I'm not going anywhere, Angeline. Kiki's so blue. Anna was a fine and expensive, a wife of Doc Maynard, who defined her into something to be owned. When she said you're much too beautiful for such an ugly name, from now on you will be known as Angeline, not Kiki Soblo. And they made her illegal, and all of her people and the children threw rocks behind the back. But Kiki Soblo had some rocks of her own, she threw them back, Angeline, Kiki Soblo. Somebody you stole something from, come to take it back from you, Angeline, Kiki Soblo. So many thieves, for all that they have taken, they leave us with a world full of holes. But we have rocks, we have heroes, we will not do what we are told, Angeline.